A few years back, History of the Saints began production of 7 seasons of a documentary television series titled History of the Saints. Season 1, Foundations of the Restoration. Season 2, Joseph Smith's Kirtland. Season 3, From Pentecost to Persecution, The Missouri Years. And Season 4, Joseph Smith's Nauvoo. Then 3 more seasons telling the story of Brigham Young and the Saints, beginning with the Nauvoo Exodus in 1846, titled Gathering to the West. Then Building Zion. And finally, The Kingdom Endures. Altogether, over 100 hours of Latter-day Saint pioneer history. For these and all of History of the Saints books and DVD products, visit us at historyofthesaints.org.
Welcome to the History of the Saints podcast. My name is Glenn Rawson, series host. What you are about to listen to is an episode about the documentary history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This episode is one of more than 250 presentations from 1805 and the birth of Joseph Smith the prophet through 1877 and the death of Brigham Young. This series interviews some of the finest scholars of our time and presents the latest in historical research and facts as it relates to early Latter-day Saint history. And it comes from the long-running, highly acclaimed television documentary series, History of the Saints. If you have a desire to learn the history in depth and detail, then this podcast is for you. Thank you for joining us. The Book of Mormon is considered by Latter-day Saints a modern-day miracle. And why is that? Because of how the book came to be. Coming up next on History of the Saints, the translation of the Book of Mormon. Tuesday, April 7th, 1829, Harmony, Pennsylvania. 23-year-old Joseph Smith Jr. and 22-year-old Oliver Cowdery began in earnest the translation of the Book of Mormon from the gold plates. By July 1st of that same summer, 1829, they had completed their work. In a span of about 85 days, they had produced what would be the 588 pages of the original 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon. And therein is our story.
Oliver is an excellent scribe. He has good handwriting, good command of the English language, good spelling abilities, not perfect because they're still spelling a lot of things phonetically, but Oliver's the right guy for this type of activity, and they move along. And this, unlike the translation with Martin Harris, which took a considerable amount of more time, they move along in this translation much more quickly than the previous attempt with Martin Harris.
When Martin takes 116 pages, he's not only taking the Book of Lehi, he's taking the beginning of the Book of Mosiah. And this is why in our current Book of Mormon, the Book of Mosiah doesn't really begin where it ought to as the Book of Mosiah. In the printer's manuscript, Oliver first wrote chapter 3 for the beginning of the Book of Mosiah. And then he crosses out the one and the... He's got three, Roman numeral 3, and he crosses out the second and the third strokes to make it chapter 1. Then he inserts above the line with little insert marks, the Book of Mosiah. So his copy didn't have the Book of Mosiah. So he is deciding this is the beginning of the Book of Mosiah. But it is quite bizarre because, first of all, the book doesn't start with Mosiah. If a book's named after somebody, it's named after the person it starts out with, even though a later record keeper may take over. The name of the book is the first record keeper. Even the Book of Alma switches to Helaman and then to Shiblon as the record keeper. Has three record keepers for the Book of Alma, but they just call it the Book of Alma because the first one was Alma. Well, the same thing, I think, you know, the Book of Mosiah is named after the father of King Benjamin.
It
It was sometime shortly after Oliver's arrival in Harmony in April of 1829 that the prophet Joseph received a revelation on Oliver's behalf. Among other things, that revelation confirmed the testimony that Oliver had received of the truthfulness of the work Joseph was doing.
Verily, verily, I say unto you, if you desire a further witness, cast your mind upon the night that you cried unto me in your heart, that you might know concerning the truth of these things. Did I not speak peace to your mind concerning the matter? What greater witness can you have than from God? And now behold, you have received a witness. For if I have told you things which no man knoweth, have you not received a witness?
So it's a very generous kind of thing, I think, for the Lord to give section 6 through Joseph's mouth to Oliver Cowdery. It had a powerful effect at confirming to Oliver Cowdery that Joseph was indeed the Lord's servant. Perfect? No. Flawlessly eloquent? No. God's handpicked servant? Yes. That's what section 6 taught to Oliver Cowdery.
That revelation also granted to Oliver, if he desired, the gift to translate from the plates. As it turned out, Oliver became exceedingly anxious to translate.
The Lord could have just said that. No, Oliver, you can't translate. Sit down, be quiet, and write day after day, hour after hour, till your hand falls off. But instead, the Lord says, yeah, well, go ahead, give it a try. See how this works. And as a result of this process, revelation, experimentation, some more revelation to explain what just happened in the experiment, Oliver learns in a way that he could not have learned if the Lord had just said no, that Joseph Smith is the right man for the job. Joseph Smith is the Lord's chosen servant. Whatever defects he has, whatever weaknesses he is the Lord's chosen seer to translate the Book of Mormon. And no one knows that better than Oliver Cowdery.
Three revelations really tie into this experience. Now, section 6 of the Doctrine and Covenants is the permission to go ahead and be able to translate this record. Section 8 tells him how to do it. Basically, you have to connect up with your mind and heart, and the revelation will be received through those faculties. And then section 9 tells him why he wasn't ultimately successful.
Behold, you have not understood. You have supposed that I would give it unto you, when you took no thought, save it was to ask me. But behold, I say unto you, that you must study it out in your mind. Then you must ask me if it be right. And if it is right, I will cause that your bosom shall burn within you. Therefore you shall feel that it is right. But if it be not right, you shall have no such feelings, but you shall have a stupor of thought.
It looks to Oliver like you just sit down and look, and all of a sudden there is the words, and you just dictate them hour after hour, as Oliver says. But Joseph Smith has spent a lot of time learning how to translate and learning how to use the gift and power of God. And Oliver needs that experience of trying it himself and failing and having the Lord explain to him. It's not as easy as you think. You don't just imagine it in your head and poof, the translation appears. So that's a really important process. That series of revelations is really important to Latter-day Saints today as well as historically, because it helps us understand that revelation comes as a process and as a result of a lot of hard work.
In the course of the translation, Joseph and Oliver would have come across passages that mention translated beings. That may have been what sparked the discussion concerning what happened to John the Beloved.
We as Latter-day Saints know, of course, that John was translated and did not taste of death. Well, for Joseph and Oliver, they would not have had that kind of understanding. I think most historical tradition suggests John is buried or died in Ephesus, but they didn't know. And so this question arises, well, how can we find out? What's interesting is the heading to that revelation says, the revelation is a translated version of the record made on parchment by John and hidden up by himself. Certainly the document's not in front of him, but he's seeing the document in visionary form, probably through the Urim and Thummim, and then provides this translation.
And the Lord said unto me, John, my beloved, what desirest thou? For if you shall ask what you will, it shall be granted unto you. And I said unto him, Lord, give unto me power over death, that I may live and bring souls unto thee.
A few years back, History of the Saints began production of 7 seasons of a documentary television series titled History of the Saints. Season 1, Foundations of the Restoration. Season 2, Joseph Smith's Kirtland. Season 3, From Pentecost to Persecution, The Missouri Years. And Season 4, Joseph Smith's Nauvoo. Then 3 more seasons telling the story of Brigham Young and the Saints, beginning with the Nauvoo Exodus in 1846, titled Gathering to the West. Then Building Zion. And finally, The Kingdom Endures. Altogether, over 100 hours of Latter-day Saint pioneer history. For these and all of History of the Saints books and DVD products, visit us at historyofthesaints.org.
It is precisely because of the difficulty of the translation process that Joseph had 2 different instruments that aided him in translating.
There was an instrument that came with the plates. And we later, Joseph Smith and others, later referred to it as a Urim and Thummim, using the Old Testament term for the 2 stones. They're apparently 2 clear, like stones, much like perhaps glass lenses. And they were, from what we understand, supposed to fit in some silver bows that were attached then to a breastplate. And all of this apparatus came with the plates to apparently assist the translator, who would somehow put on the breastplate and the silver rods with the 2 stones, the interpreters, as they called them, and would then somehow be able to use that in viewing the plates and getting the translation. As far as we know, that apparatus was never used in that direct way. But there was a time period in which the 2 clear stones were used, and they were referred at the time to as the interpreters, or sometimes the Nephite interpreters. There was, though, another instrument which Joseph Smith used, and most people who saw the translation process believed in this second, said that this was the instrument he was using. And we Latter-day Saints have called it a seer stone. And this particular seer stone that he used was supposed to be the size of an egg, a hen's egg, I think they sometimes referred to it as, that it was dark-colored, brownish, and it was not clear seen through like the Nephite interpreters, but was opaque. Martin Harris said that he, for convenience, but he doesn't explain what the convenience is, but he says for convenience, Joseph preferred using the seer stone.
Some have wondered why Joseph had these instruments in the first place.
It's interesting to look in other places where we see prophets using instruments. And you see some common denominators here. Lehi, for example, with the Liahona. Moses and Aaron with their rod. Take that little group right there in Joseph Smith. Common denominator is that they're all... I mean, Moses and Aaron are starting something up after 300 years of apostasy. And God gives them an instrument to help it out. Lehi, coming out of a very apostate Jerusalem, on the verge of being destroyed, it's so wicked, and heading out into the middle of nowhere where the support system's going to be, as far as mortals go, pretty limited, and he has an instrument. And I think that's what you see with these instruments that Joseph Smith has. He's given them to help focus his mind, something tangible, something where, I mean, he's got a book here in an unknown tongue, and he's told to translate it. And, you know, you gotta kind of grip something and say, okay, how am I going to do this? And give me some help here. And through the Urim and Thummim, which I think the records would indicate that he uses that primarily, predominantly, early on. Maybe not solely, but That's sort of the instrument of choice early on. And then over time, he switches to the seer stone. And I think what you see there is him going from something that he got from an angel that was, and he was told this specifically was made so for the translation of ancient languages. And that allows him to get the faith to translate. And when he starts getting this revelation down a little bit, then he can switch to something maybe not quite so fancy, but a lot more handy. The seer stone that you can carry around in your pocket. And by the time we're doing the Joseph Smith translation or the Abraham papyri or later revelations that are now in the Doctrine and Covenants, by the time we're there, we don't need an instrument at all. And I think what you see is Joseph Smith progressively getting better at doing it. But he needed some help early on because he didn't have the background that most of the rest of us enjoy here. Even then, I think you can still see some things, physical things we use today to help get our minds in the state where we can receive revelation. I look at, say, the sacrament as an easy one. Compare the sacrament with a seer stone, and they may seem worlds apart, but honestly, I think there's some similarities. Two very commonplace objects, right? Water that you can get out of a tap, bread that you can buy at the store, and a rock that you can pick up off the ground. Very commonplace. But in the right context, with the right authority, the bread and the water are a very important means, of course, for obtaining the Spirit of God and obtaining revelation through obtaining the Spirit through which we receive revelation. And in the right context, a simple rock can be a very important aid for receiving revelation as well. Revelation doesn't come easy, even for a prophet. And Joseph needed that little something to hold on to in order to get that revelation to come. And then he got the hang of it and was able to lay those things aside.
The traditional view in Mormon academic scholarly studies is that somehow in the process Joseph Smith was given the ideas and then it was his job to translate it into his English. And I think the evidence throughout, and we're going to talk about some of this evidence, is that no, actually, the Lord gave a fully completed text to Joseph Smith, that through the instrument that he was given, he could read off this text. It was in English, and he would read it off to the scribe who would write it down. And it is a specific text that is not Joseph Smith's.
He did not use the plates in the translation, but would hold the interpreters to his eyes and cover his face with a hat, excluding all light. And before his eyes would appear what seemed to be a parchment, on which would appear the characters of the plates in a line at the top, and immediately below would appear the translation in English, which Smith would read to his scribe, who wrote it down exactly as it fell from his lips. David Whitmer.
Now, David Whitmer said that if the scribe made any mistake whatsoever, the text on the seer stone would not, it would not disappear. It would stay there. And so Joseph Smith knew that the clerk had not copied it down correctly. But the translation process itself was an oral event, word of mouth. I think sometimes we don't remember that. The very first audience to the English Book of Mormon is Joseph Smith reading it out loud and his scribe, usually Oliver Cowdery, hearing it. The Book of Mormon was an oral text to the very first audience.
There were six contemporary witnesses to the translation process who later left accounts of what they saw. Among them, Emma Smith. In a later interview with her son, Joseph Smith III, this is what Sister Emma said.
My belief is that the Book of Mormon is of divine authenticity. I have not the slightest doubt of it. I am satisfied that no man could have dictated the writing of the manuscripts unless he was inspired. For when acting as his scribe, your father would dictate to me hour after hour, and when returning after meals or after interruptions, he would at once begin where he had left off, without either seeing the manuscript or having any portion of it read to him. This was a usual thing for him to do. It would have been improbable that a learned man could do this, and for one so ignorant and unlearned as he was, it was simply impossible. Emma Smith.
She said that Joseph could just start up anywhere he was. That is, he didn't have to be told where he had ended. And I believe that's because when he would finish a session, he could sort of quit it, and the instrument would come up with the next section. So he knew this would happen. He didn't really have to worry. He didn't have to say, now where was I before? You see, he's not constructing the text. It's being given to him.
Another evidence that the text was given to the prophet Joseph word for word is some of the spellings.
We have actual evidence in the original manuscript where Oliver Cowdery in several places would first write a name phonetically, more or less, and it'll be crossed out and it'll be written properly in line. And one of them is Corey Antimer, and he wrote it T-U-M-M-E-R at the end. It's all crossed out, and then he writes it correctly, T-U-M-R. What's really funny is his R goes like this with a huge swirl, and he never wrote an R like that anywhere else. It's just sort of like him saying, how do you expect me to spell this, M-R? You know, no vowel. And this is really strong evidence for what the witnesses said, that he was spelling out names.
Now, the way he translated was he put the Urim and Thummim into his hat and darkened his eyes. Then he would take a sentence and it would appear in bright Roman letters. Then he would tell the writer and he would write it. That would go away and the next sentence would come, and so on. But if it was not spelled right, it would not go away till it was right. So we see it was marvelous. Thus was the whole translated. Joseph Knight Sr.
And indeed, it was a marvelous work and a wonder. Joseph and Oliver were translating and got as far as 3 Nephi and the Savior's visit to the Americas. There they saw the Savior's teachings about baptism. That caused them to wonder. They went out to pray, and a wonderful thing happened. That's our story next time. I'm Glenn Rawson, and we'll see you then.
Thank you for listening. If you would like more information on what you have listened to, please go to historyofthesaints.org. The History of the Saints team that produced this podcast has also produced numerous books and full-length documentaries on early Latter-day Saint church history and the key figures that made that history. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast of History of the Saints has been produced by Dennis Lyman and Glenn Rawson. History of the Saints is a 501c3 nonprofit organization.